My full name is Carol Ann Pegg. My place of birth is Nottingham. My date of birth is September the 19th, 1944.
Thank you. And could you tell me a little bit about your parents and your upbringing, particularly perhaps reflecting on the role of music in your early years, early memories of music and of music making and that sort of thing?
Right, so I'm from the working class. Most of my family on both sides were Nottinghamshire miners. My parents broke away and both became factory workers. And my first memory of music is my own music making. This is my first memory of music. Me getting all the children of the neighbourhood and them forming an audience and me going up the three steps in front of our front door and performing to them. What's the word I meant? Precocious, you know, very precocious of me. Then I always wanted to play the piano, but we had a small house and there wasn't room for a piano. And so I learnt the violin at school, had some private lessons, joined the county orchestra, and then there was a bit of a gap. There was a gap in the fiddle playing, because I then got interested in folk music and I went down to the folk club in Nottingham. Oh dear, yes, I should have looked them up. The name of the folk club, I can't remember.
We can put that in later.
Yes. That's right, the first song I sang in public was at Nottingham University, and I had this chap who accompanied me on the guitar. And the first song I sang in public was The House of the Rising Sun. And that was the kind of the lead-in then to performing. So went to the Cambridge Folk Club, formed a trio with my husband to be, my first husband to be, Bob Peck, another musician, Gil Evans. And then eventually we dropped Gil. And we began to do television, so we did local television. And I went off to do English and French at Southampton University. He went off to do English and folklore studies at Leeds University. But we met up and kept doing local television and became sort of well known around Nottingham. And then I left and married him. So I didn't finish that first stint at university. I just did 1 year. And we then formed this folk rock band, Mr. Fox, which has become a classic band because we were the first person who used English traditional instrumental sounds. We wrote our own songs using folk traditional themes. And by then I'd fed back in the violin, but the violin became the fiddle. So I unlearned the classical style. Bob was doing a PhD on folk music of the Yorkshire Dales. And so I learned from some fiddle players in the Yorkshire Dales. First of all, I suppose we became quite well known as a duo doing the folk clubs, Bob and Carol Pegg. And as the duo, we ran a folk club in Leeds. We got a lot of traditional people playing at the folk club. We were very anti-guitar. You know, we had Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger up to perform and do workshops, and Irish musicians. And so basically visited people like Harry Cox, very famous English traditional singer, but who also was a fiddle player, and these fiddle players in the Yorkshire Dales. And I listened to a lot of kind of Morris fiddling and put together, you know, an English traditional fiddle style. And it's rather gratifying now to see that it's taken hold, and the, you know, the folk revival now has some very famous people, Eliza Carthay, for instance. Well, Eliza Carthay. Is it Eliza Carthay? Anyway, some very famous people who are using that traditional style. Yes, it is Eliza Carthay. Now, I was getting confused because her father, Martin, is very, very famous for the guitar style. And I suppose, you know, my working class roots has always made me interested in the music of the working people. And partly that's probably what inspired me to go into anthropology when my marriage broke down. Having been professional for a few years and done, well, we did two Mr. Fox LPs, we did a Bob and Carol Pegg, two Bob and Carol Pegg LPs, and then I did my singer-songwriter album after that. Actually, I did my singer-songwriter album after Mr. Fox split up and I'd left Bob. And from that, I then moved to Cambridge. At the time I made the singer-songwriter album...
Sorry, what year was that album?
1972.
Okay.
At the time I made that, I was jobless and busking in the underground in London, which was a great experience. I should have got some wonderful tales about that. And then I came to Cambridge and I went up to the university and sat the exam and was very surprised when I got in. By then I must have been about 32. You could do the maths on that, I might have got that wrong, but early 30s anyway.
So you'd recorded your solo album in 1972. And then came and started at Cambridge in 1976.
Yes, and in between that I'd had a band and toured the band. But then I moved to Cambridge maybe a couple of years before going up to... I moved to Cambridge and worked for the Open University for a couple of years. Then one day walked up and took their entrance exam. And then thought, oh my God, I've got in. Because I hadn't done any academic work since, you know, I'd been 21. And it seemed rather a daunting proposition. My first year I did in religious studies. I kind of went up there with a six-year plan. First year would be religious studies, partly because of... various psychic experiences of seeing ghosts and worrying about all of that kind of thing. So I wanted to understand or try and understand different belief systems. So I did Buddhism and various different belief systems in my first year, and then changed to anthropology. And in the final year of anthropology, I did a dissertation on the music of East Suffolk. This was the first time they'd had an anthropologist doing music. And through the dissertation, the undergraduate dissertation, I convinced them that there was a PhD worth of material there. So then I became the first person to do music as a subject within anthropology at Cambridge.
Who supervised you in that?
Jack Goody, Professor Jack Goody, who was an Africanist, was absolutely visionary. You know, he took oddballs under his wing, basically. He had an Italian chap who was doing carnival and people who were rather inspired. and not doing politics, economics, kinship, or ritual, you know, religion and ritual. His good deed was in giving me a place, you know. I mean, he actually didn't teach me particularly, but he just allowed me that space to do it. So,
and were
well, thanks go to him.
Yeah.
Yes.
And were you in touch with or inspired by any other, whether you might call them ethnomusicologists or not, but people working within anthropology on music or within music on...
Not at that point, really. Mm. I was really rather more in touch with musicians still. So Taffy Thomas helped me. He had a gypsy caravan over in Suffolk. And he kind of let me go and stay there initially while I figured out where exactly I was going to do the research. I did it in Blacksall, and the like a 3-mile square area around Blacksall. So I took in the Snake Maltings and Benjamin Britten, but you know, the pub in Blacksall where they were inheriting music within families, and working class people were actually joining together with gypsies and doing step dancing and all of those things. I was reading anthropology rather than ethnomusicology at that point. But once I had finished my PhD and my daughter went off to Goldsmiths to do a degree, I then thought, right, you know... Where am I going to go? Because I didn't feel like a proper anthropologist. Because I'd worked in this country, which was unusual then, and of course is expected now, you know, normal now. Mm. And my peer group had been sending me postcards and letters from, you know, South America, Africa, all of these places, and because my daughter, a single parent, you know, my daughter was going through the school system, I chose Suffolk. I should say that another first, which I was quite proud of, was that as part of the PhD, I submitted a video film called Tune Up at the Ship. And this caused a great consternation. What should we do with this video film? Is it a footnote? How are we going to, you know? But anyway, so that was the first Cambridge University PhD that had a video film submitted. And that, previous to that, I had done a course when people were using Super 8. I'd done a film course within the university, which led on to me wanting to do this video film. So I took a crew with me from the university and filmed this thing in the ship, intercutting it with interviews that I'd done in the field with these people.
I was wondering, I think because you were about to tell me about
the next
step, could I ask you a little bit more about your PhD first? Particularly, I suppose, with your background as a performer, do you have any reflections particularly on your approach to research or performance as research or those sorts of issues at that stage, for example?
Yes, it was very important that I was able to produce the right sounds with my fiddle. The, you know, historically in that area, It would have been the local people in that parish who performed in that pub, and the working class people. So not the lords in the big houses who were bringing people in internationally, and you know, had a different sound ideal. Not the middle class people. It was people who could produce particular sounds, and at the time when I was doing my research, it had broadened. I mean, strangers were still not particularly welcome, but strangers still meant people who couldn't produce the right sounds. Okay, so you there was a network system so that neighbouring parishes, musicians, would come and perform. And a few people that I called neo-traditionalists were those people who could produce the right sounds. So when I was living in Blacksall, I inherited a song, The Yellow Handkerchief, which is, you know, now quite well known. And I was the one who got up and sang that song, and other local people all had their songs that they would sing, and we contributed, and it became a company, you know, became a community through it. So it was very important. Participant observation was very important to the whole thing, really. Yeah.
And was that back in Cambridge, where you were writing it up and presenting and so on, was that quite a novel approach, or were quite accepted?
Well, the big point to make, I suppose, is that my ethnomusicology comes out of anthropology. I see ethnomusicology as a continuum between these two poles. At the one end you've got the anthropologists, at the other end you've got the musicologists, although I know at the moment there is a move for musicology to embrace all of it. But it seems to me that they are such different perspectives, because the musicologist is very concerned with the note. You know, they start with the note and go out from the sound. The anthropologist rather more looks at the whole and is very interested in who's producing that note and why are they making those particular sounds. And at the time when I was doing my participant observation, that was a classic methodology within social anthropology. So, you know, I had been trained to do that, and that's what I was doing. Of course, theories moved on, and these days the idea that you go in and you look at something objectively, of course, is no longer the way. I don't think I ever really thought that I was looking at things objectively in that sense. Although I was aware that by being different, you noticed things that otherwise you wouldn't. So when I first got to Suffolk, things were rather strange because I'm a city girl, or in those days I had been a city girl. Living in a rural area where you actually couldn't understand the local people because the accent was so strong. And you noticed all kinds of things. Of course, when you've been living there for a year, it's the same as if you're living in Africa for a year, that you start to get used to certain things, and you perhaps haven't got such a keen sense of, difference and questioning of what's going on. Mm. Yes. So I am very much up the anthropological end of the spectrum. Mm.
And I suppose I sort of partly asked you this already, but at that stage, were you particularly aware of people, say, either within the UK or within the US, for example, working within anthropology but branching into music, in terms of other studies going on and similar approaches?
Well, of course I must have been. I mean, of course John Blacking was doing his thing in Ireland. The thing was, Blacking did want me to go and study there, but I had a daughter who already had been traumatised, and one of the reasons I came off the road and went into university was, you know, to give her a bit more stability. And he was quite disappointed.
So you'd met him previous to starting in Cambridge?
Yes. Well, of course, I was a member of the International Council for Traditional Music, as it was called in those days.
Or folk
UK.
Music.
Didn't quite go back as far as the International Folk Music Council.
Can you tell me about how you first heard of and joined? So it was the UK chapter of the ICTM.
Yes, yeah. That's right. I went along and gave, conference papers.
But this
English
was
traditional music.
While you were performing, principally?
It was while I was doing my PhD.
Okay. So
yes.
you heard about this sort of when you were beginning to come into academia?
Yes, when I was performing, of course, I knew about Cecil Sharp House, did concerts at Cecil Sharp House, got very annoyed with the English Folk Dance and Song Society because they seemed to be controlling things and, you know, got involved in all those little dramas of the time. So it was more that than the ICTM, which was like the academic side of things. So I got interested in that when I became a PhD student, I think.
And do you have any particular early memories of your involvement or perceptions of those early meetings that you went to particularly?
Well,
how they influenced you, I guess.
Initially, I went along and gave my papers and enjoyed the kind of stimulation of knowing other people were doing similar things, albeit not in the, in this country. Then I became more enmeshed in it and became a committee member, and together with Richard Widdis and David Hughes, was there somebody else? We set up the journal, British Forum for Ethnic Musicology. What was it? Budgie, we always used to call it, which we thought was particularly appropriate.
That was in 1992.
Perhaps I should just get the first copy down.
Yep,
and
should
see
we pause?
Who the other editor was.
So just continuing, we were at the moment when you co-founded the British Journal for Ethnomusicology, I should say.
British Journal of Ethnomusicology with John Bailey, David Hughes and Richard Widdis. And so it was an exciting time, you know, because we were stimulating each other. I don't have the date in my head, but eventually I became the chairperson of the...
Here it says 89 to 94.
Okay, so I was already chairperson. Yeah. So while I was chairperson, I helped to inaugurate this British Journal of Ethnomusicology, which has now become the British Forum, the... What is it?
Ethnomusicology Forum.
Ethnomusicology Forum and the... organisation is the British Forum for Ethnomusicology. It was an exciting time meeting other ethnomusicologists, but my PhD, you see, I finished that in 1986.
So that was a few years before this all occurred. So you've been sort of engaged
so,
with the forum or the council, as it was then called.
Yes, yes.
For some time.
Yes, I'd been to... And I'd organised conferences for them as well. But when was the period of organising conferences?
Yes, you'd convened various... before that...
Well, oh no, that was giving paper, yes. Sorry, I should have read this. Here, look.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah, okay, so, no, that was...
So 1994.
1990. Oh, I see,
oh,
I've done it the other way. So before we founded the journal, I'd convened a conference at King's College in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
89, yeah.
And the following year.
And the following year in the Horniman, mm-hmm. and the following, 5 years later again back in King's College in Cambridge.
And do you have any, I don't know, sort of memories, I guess, leading up, for example, to the founding of the journal and your sort of early memories of I guess, key figures and that have particularly impacted, I guess, your own career and work and...
Well, I mean, the trouble is, you know, I've always wanted to plough my own furrow. I think, in a sense, you know, I've never completely belong to ethnomusicology and never completely belong to social anthropology. I've always been kind of on the edges of the two disciplines. And striking out, if you know what I mean. So I can't think that there was anyone who particularly influenced my PhD. Then when I went off and started working in Mongolia.
So could you talk me through how that came about, perhaps? So you'd been
well, yes,
working
now
in
it
Suffolk.
Came about. Yes,
you
from
finished
East
PhD.
Suffolk to West Mongolia. I thought that was quite a good leap, really. And very similar in that they all get together and they, you know, they in Suffolk have their booze and in you know, they have their pints, and in West Mongolia they have their fermented and distilled mare's milk, you know, and they get jolly and then they all sing. So it's quite similar in that sense. And also I felt incredibly comfortable with those herders. I think, you know, being working class, I'm comfortable with working class people, basically, even though, you know, whether you'd call them a class or something else. But yes, so it came about through my interest in film, partly. Okay, so I'd done the half an hour video film, Tune Up at the Ship. And immediately after the PhD, I went to Exeter and I worked with David Horn and Paul Oliver, the blues chap, on Ep Mau, the Encyclopedia of Popular Music of the World. I just did a sort of feasibility study for them of it. I think it came out quite recently, so they got there in the end. I then came back to Cambridge and I made a video film on Lawrence Pickin, who was a fellow of Jesus College, and I'd got to know him and I thought his life and work should be documented. Mm. So I raised this very small amount of money, I think it was £300, and I went into the university studio and dressed it up as if it was a drawing room. And then got from Lawrence pictures of his work, well, of his childhood. He also came from Nottingham, and he'd worked in Turkey before he began his work in China, and he'd got photographs of instruments and people, you know, from the Turkish period. And basically the film is me interviewing him and intercutting, same kind of technique that I use for Tune Up at the Ship, and finishing with some video film that of music of the Tongue Court, which was the project he had right up until the end. So while I was doing all of that, Lawrence played me some recordings of Mongolian music, and it was at a time when I was thinking, where shall I go to become a real anthropologist? I'd thought about South America because I'd always been drawn to that. I was told every community has its own social anthropologist in South America. So, and then I thought Turkey, because some of those recordings of Lawrence's, you know, Black Sea fiddle players bagpipe players and things, wonderful. But he played me this Mongolian music, and I had never heard anything like it, and no one had done research on it, basically. And simultaneously, there had been in academia in the UK two professors who were teaching Mongolian studies. There was a professor, Ogungi Onun, in Leeds, and Charles Borden in the University of London. And both of those retired, both of those people. So there's no university covering Mongolian studies. And one of the lecturers in the social anthropology department said that she wanted to set up a research unit for Mongolian studies. And was I interested
in Cambridge? In Cambridge.
Yeah. Was I interested in helping her set it up? And I said, well, only if I get to do my own research. So we basically set up the Mongolia and Inner Asia Studies Unit within the Department of Social Anthropology. And I kind of did all the hands-on stuff. So we invited Mongolian teachers, language teachers, and ran seminars. And I began to teach, not as a full-time lecturer, but teach courses in social anthropology department, the anthropology of music. And I found that students from ethnomusicology would come. So that was very enjoyable, you know, trying to bring them into, to give them ideas about anthropological perspectives, you know, music students. Teaching courses on Mongolian music. But basically, I started out learning Mongolian language and running this unit. And then I got my own research funding and I went off. And I'm trying to think, was I particularly influenced? I've been more influenced by anthropologists, I think, really, you know. I've just returned from Mongolia, having had a gap of 12 years. So I did my research in Mongolia from 1989 to 1998, right? However, in 1987, I'd gone to Tibet and Inner Mongolia, northern China. In 1988, I brought to the UK 11 musicians and dancers and toured them. That is a whole story of itself. Mongolians have a different sense of time. Getting them to concerts was quite difficult, but that was a big experience. But the thing was that when I then went to Mongolia in 1989, when it was still communist, part of the Soviet bloc, even though nominally independent, I looked the musicians up and I was able to dodge the communist apparatchiks who, you know, wanted to restrict what I could see. And I remember we were in one area for 3 weeks before they found me and turfed me out, you know. Yes, my mind was just drifting back to a similar experience in Inner Mongolia when we were taken to the police station for being in the wrong area. But anyway, those musicians helped me and I was very committed to things Mongolian until my book was written, was completed. And that really wasn't completed until I'd finished my stint in charge of the update of New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians. And I might as well just run through this now since I was, when the book came out, I then moved to work north of the West Mongolian border in a range of mountains that runs through West Mongolia, which is where I became particularly interested in their spiritual beliefs and how that linked in with the music they were making. And so I moved just north of the border. So it was 12 years since I'd been to Mongolia when suddenly, out of the blue, I got an invitation to go and give a keynote address at this conference on cultural heritage. And it was so wonderful to go back there because in the intervening 12 years, suddenly everybody knew my work. Whereas previously, you know, I'd kind of just mingled with the people and not particularly mingled with academia, you know. And the remarkable thing was that 1989 to 1990, I was there 89, 90, 92, 5 field trips, and the longest one was 8 months, the others were like 4 months or something, kind of. It was over the cusp of the end of communism and the beginning of democracy. And in 1989, people felt able to share with me their traditional music and their spiritual beliefs, because things were loosening up, ready for 1990 when the change happened. And these traditions had gone to ground in the communist period, in the round felt tent, in the middle of the steppe, you know, posted a guard outside the door, did their shamanic ritual, things like that. They've gone to ground. So they were able to, they felt able to share those things with me, and I was able to record them and do videos and things. And the academics there at the time were themselves coping with the change and didn't have the funding or the time or the opportunity to be doing, to be out in all those remote areas. And I decided that it wasn't clear whether it was going to remain open, you know. It had been closed for, since 1921 or something, you know. No Western researchers been in there. And so I decided I'm not going to just stay with one group in traditional anthropological fashion. I'm going to try and understand all these different former tribes and try and understand what they're doing with their music, you know, and set the stall out, really, so that other people could come and say, oh, the Bayad people have got very interesting throat singing, or, you know, bee dance or whatever. I will go in depth into that particular one. So I did a kind of very old-fashioned anthropological, old-fashioned in that sense, although the theories I used were not old-fashioned. So I was arguing that through performance, these people were performing their identities, which were multiple. So they were referring to their particular tribal histories or the confederation that the tribe had been in. They were saying, I'm a woman, I'm from this tribe, and we do our bee dance in this way, and we are different from our neighbours. We, the Bayad, do it in a very pronounced way, and we put fermented mare's milk on our knees, you know, bowls full of fermented mare's milk, because we don't move our legs when we dance, and we don't spill the fermented mare's milk. They, the Dorvot, they do these little movements, and they put the fermented mare's milk on their head. So they were expressing difference from their neighbours and similarity and status within their group. And so I argued for the performance of identities through music and dance. And what was so wonderful was that the academics had found the book, and were even using it to teach Mongolian musicians about their cultural heritage. Very bizarre, you know. But just very gratifying in a way that they'd found the book, and it was useful for them, and we're now trying to get it translated into Mongolian so that, you know, ordinary Mongols can afford it. Mm. Because the prices that American publishers well, and of course English publishers as well, yeah. European. Yes, so,
and have the recordings and films and so on you've made also been used in a similar way in Mongolia?
Well, now I'm about to try and do something about those recordings. return them to the Mongolians. But that's, I'm starting to think of my next project, and that's the intention, to build that in. In between, you see, the next 12 years after I stopped going to Mongolia, I moved up to the Altai Mountains in southern Siberia. So I've been working in Altai Republic, Tuvan Republic, and Hakassia, Republic of Hakassia. And again, shooting video as well as sound. And I'm trying to finish the book as a result of that project, which is specializing on spiritual beliefs. So it all comes back to that first year, that, you know, the spiritual beliefs are so very different from ours. When they do their throat singing and make these musical sounds, or even sounds, you know, the use of sound in communicating with these different dimensions, I find all of that very, very fascinating. So that's the project I'm trying to round up. And the next one, I perceive, will be more about returning all these things to these places. I mean, I'm about to head off to Altai to do a 2-month video recording trip, again based around a particular ritual. And I'm working with Alteans, you know, with an Altaian team, 3 Alteans and me. And they will certainly be archiving the stuff. So theory's moved on, you know, it's not acceptable now to just go and do it and come back and use it, really. It's got to be a joint effort, and the local people have got to be able to, you know, enjoy it and use it in the way that they and input into what you're doing. So but the trouble is, as I say, that, I mean, I suppose the ethnomusicologist that I always taught from was Alan Merriam's The Anthropology of Music. And his model, even though it's dated, you know, it was of its time. It had very vital things in there that we still use. So how people think about music, you know, the conceptualization and the person producing the sounds, and how they behave to do that in other ways, not only plucking the instrument, and then the sound itself, and through an audience, you know, the interaction with the audience, how the performer is situated, which is very much of the essence today, really. Of course, there were things that I criticised in it, but I would still say that perhaps he was one of the people that, you know, deeply, deeply influenced me. But I guess I've always been trying to look for new ways, you know, and some of the anthropological theories were the things that excited me, really. Yeah.
And would you say, there's sort of 2 areas I want to look at. Maybe if we think first, while we're thinking about your, you know, influences in your life, within, again, the British context, do you perceive any sort of development of a British ethnomusicology in any way? And if so, how would you describe it? I'm not, I mean, maybe there isn't one.
Well, I think the anthropology of music hasn't been developed as much as I would have liked. I think they do they do a good job in Belfast. Of course, when Blacking died, he was such a charismatic man, that I think we still feel his loss, actually. And Suzelle Riley has done a great job of continuing that tradition. I think I can't look and see that there is an anthropologist in position. It seems to me that maybe musicology is on the rise. But I could be wrong about that, because I'm so very much involved with anthropology that I could be wrong about that. I mean, I think Tina Ramnarine is doing great things as well. And the fact that at SOAS they have got such a lively programme and a clutch of people lecturing in ethnomusicology has got to be a good thing. You know, in Cambridge it never happened. It was always too difficult for the lone ethnomusicologist in Cambridge to develop it in any significant way at all. And in SOAS it's become very strong, but I wonder how much anthropology is taught there. Perhaps the balance anyway is in favour of musicology rather than anthropology. I think Keith Howard was trained in anthropology and his work has anthropology. But I'm not sure about the other one. So my own feeling is it's a shame that there isn't a really strong anthropological thread in British ethnomusicology.
And I'd love to hear if you have any particular memories, of Blacking, and again how your interactions with him, and you mentioned briefly earlier that he had encouraged you initially to come to Belfast, which obviously you couldn't because of your daughter, but it'd be great to hear about anything you remember of him in particular. Should we pause? So you're just saying to me about the fact that you don't feel you've necessarily been an institutionalised person, as it were. Sorry, that sounds terrible. You know,
well,
what I mean?
Not an institutional person.
Sorry, yes.
because I've always, in a sense, worked for myself and taught in different places. You know, I taught I've taught ethnomusicology in the music faculty, and I'm currently attached as an affiliated scholar to the music faculty here. I've taught many, many years in the social anthropology department. I've taught in Anglia Ruskin University, and so I've never been. I've never had a lectureship that has allowed me to develop the anthropology of music in any sustained kind of way. And as a result of that, I've always done what I felt more comfortable with, actually, which is mixing performance, my own songwriting and filmmaking and my own interests with the academia. So some people possibly think I'm too reclusive in that sense, but it is actually the only way I can do everything to the best of my ability, really, by going to ground and becoming very intense on one thing and, you know, doing that and then moving on to the next. And so it's not the normal kind of career path. It's mixed performance and academia and filmmaking, really.
But that gives you a very unique perspective on, I suppose, how things have developed.
Yes. Yes, if I had, stood back enough and examined it all. But I tend to be a bit blinkered, I suppose.
But certainly your engagement with the British Forum for Ethnomusicology, well, an ICTM UK chapter as it was, and
Yes, for many years I was deeply involved, and as we said, you know, convened some conferences for them and contributed and edited, first on the editorial board, then as the reviews editor, and then as a member of the international board for probably 20 years, you know, been involved with that community.
So I suppose in terms of your international involvement, would you see anything particularly distinctive about how British ethnomusicology has developed as opposed to ethnomusicology in other parts of the world? I mean,
well, that was the idea of calling it the British Journal of Ethnomusicology. The hope was that we would encourage particular perspectives and give British people, you know, an organ through which to develop their thoughts. But, of course, you know, globalisation has happened in a big way since then. And so I can see that there's an argument for including European and American scholars, which is, I think, what is now the perspective and why it's become Ethnomusicology Forum. They've taken the British out. Yeah, I think you'd have to ask somebody else whether they thought there was a British ethnomusicology. I am very interested in difference. I am less interested in the connection of sameness, you know. So I'm interested in why are the Mongolians so different? Is it to do with their landscape? Is it to do with their kinship structure? Why are they different from us? And when I think of world music, I'm interested in the world music in the sense of giving a platform for them expressing their difference. I'm not interested in the world music that has the power relation of the West, you know, saying in the recording studio to the mbira player, please take out the jangles, it's messing up my recording. You know, I'm in a sense, I think it's a shame it's not remained the British Journal, because having worked for many years in Inner Asia, those peoples that I work with have got an amazing sense of place, you know, how they're situated in terms of their place in landscape, in social place, in the cosmos. And that's something that I can relate to. And that's the thing that I'm interested in exploring, really. What makes them them, and why do they want to make those sounds, as opposed to, you know, operatic sounds of the West? Or, of course, some people do, but, you know.
Could we now maybe talk a little bit about your experiences of making recordings, audio and video and so on. I suppose thinking back again to your first experiences of making recordings, presumably in this country actually to begin with, but a more general question, why have you, do you make recordings and video recordings and so on, and how maybe have your reasons changed? And also, how have those recordings been used throughout your recording career?
I suppose, initially, people made recordings of me. This was the start, really. I remember the first time I heard myself on a sampler record. It was three tracks. And in those days, you didn't have tape recorders and listen to yourself all the time. So the first time I heard myself singing, I fainted. I was so shocked. I thought it was so awful. And actually, I changed my voice after that. And so I, from then, I was aware of the power of recording and the issue of representation and what it meant to the person, you know.
When would that have been?
Well, it must have been about 1970 mm-hmm. or 69, something like that. And various things. With me, it's been a learning process through mistakes, you know. When I did Tune Up at the Ship, I used radio mics. One of the singers went to the toilet with his radio mic on. And therefore I thought, right, you have to say, you know, you kind of, when I was in Northwest Mongolia, my video camera wouldn't work because it was too cold. It drops to minus 60. But by that point, I'd realised if you're going to do any recording at all, you've got to take backup equipment with you. So I was able, my tape recorder would work and I'd got my camera. So I was able to cover myself. You know, a series of potential disasters throughout 25 or 30 years or whatever it is of recording has just accumulated, so that in terms of technology, I'm aware of difficulties. Of course, I did also for a while teach film within the university here, and of course the same kind of theories that have gone through academia are also irrelevant for film. So not only are you a stranger going into a place, but you're a stranger going in with all this technology, especially if you're taking your backup with you, you know. I mean, I, for many years, had got no room in my luggage for clothes, you know, because I'd got batteries. Equipment was big in those days, you know. Backup microphone, hundreds of batteries, leads, and of course it's intrusive, or it can be intrusive, and there is some kind of balance to be struck, you know, and ways round things of maybe recording more than you need by just having it running instead of saying, right now, please, can you perform? You know, trying to get the other sounds that are going on, not some clean recording that's suitable for you, but a recording that is something to do with what's happening in that event, or socially, or even in terms of the landscape. Of course, it's a bit of a battle because technology is changing all the time, and there are debates about, you know, are we really sure that digital technology is, how long is it going to last, and shouldn't we keep hold of our tapes in case, and, you know, I mean, there's always these sort of technological developments, and along with those, the ethical developments that's happened. The trouble is that sometimes the ethical developments, if I can give you an example of what's running through my head is, for instance, the idea that you go with a sheaf of papers that form a contract and you go to your remote tent in the middle of the Altai Mountains and you say, before I do anything, can you sign this, please, you know. That equally, along with too much technology, is going to put the entire relationship on a different footing, an economic relationship, where as an anthropologist what you're trying to do is understand how they come at things, not how you want to organise it to make things comfortable for your future productions in the West or something, you know. So There are all those sort of issues that you have to kind of balance up with your own fieldwork situation. I mean, I think for current technology, you've got to think, if I take a digital recorder with me, and possibly a digital audio and video recorder, if in order to free up my space on my little card, I have to copy that to a computer, if that means all of my recording devices are electronically dependent, then what happens if it drops to minus 60 and none of it works? You know, I think every field worker has got to take into account their own situation and understand what they're going to. You know, there's a lot to be said for recce trips to your fieldwork area before you go and do your fieldwork. That's what I've always tried to do, so that I understand, you know, it's no good, that's not going to work. I'm going to have to do it with my pencil and my pad, you know. Because different things suit different situations, really. I mean, the good news is all the equipment's getting smaller, isn't it? And there are ways of making it less intrusive, so the video camera holding it down and doing it so that it's not in between you and the other person. But, I mean, I have to say, video for me has been extremely useful, in that if you're trying to make sense of the material, maybe 2 years later, a way of getting yourself back sensually in the environment, excuse me, is to look at the visual as well as listen to the recordings. Of course, the recordings trigger it as well, but you can notice things from a video recording that you don't notice, you don't have the opportunity with the audio recording. I tend to do both, you know. I have an audio recorder going as part of my backup strategy, but also because I think there are different things that you can do with audio. Yeah.
So, sorry, excuse me if this sounds like a very obvious question, but why do you make the recordings, and what do you do with them?
Yes. Well, I deposit them in places where other people can use them. I never feel I can deposit them until I've written the book or I've completed the work that I wanted to do. So I tend to be a bit slow in the deposit. I suppose over the last decade, I've committed myself to depositing my audio and video recordings with the National Sound Archive and also with the music faculty here. However, the Mongolian stuff, which I am now, because I've been lured back, and of course, you know, a big part of my heart is in Mongolia and that part of the world, I'm now considering what I should be doing with those recordings and with the recordings of my current project in Altai. And I am wanting to return those to those peoples out there, not only deposit them here. But I think what the position that I've arrived at quite recently is that, in a sense, recordings aren't enough, because what recordings do is document the moment. I'm also, at the moment, I'm on the board of a project in Cambridge that is called the World Oral Literature Project. And its brief is to save endangered oral literature. And for me, you know, oral literature, I'm particularly interested in epics. I've done a lot of work with epics of West Mongolia and Altai. But it is also folk orally transmitted things, which we know go in and out of print and all of those arguments. But where the involvement with that project has brought me to is that... is it enough to just document and preserve? I think not. You know, what are we actually wanting to save? And because I'm an anthropologist, I come back round to the people. I want to know, you know, is there something we can do to encourage those people who are performing that music? Not just go along and take it away and put it in an archive that requires somebody to go along to and think, oh, how interesting, and let's write a paper on that, you know. And so I have just written a paper for this organisation that's going to be published by a SOAS journal, that is saying, can we not actually broaden the brief so that what we do is encourage the performers, you know, encourage the living tradition. And as I told you, I was rather surprised to discover that my book was being used in Mongolia to do just that. But that doesn't, there's something not quite right about that even. There's something a bit disconcerting about that to me, you know. So that's the position I'm now in, I'm thinking. And I suppose, you see, one thing I've not talked about, one of the other things that I've done in parallel with all of this was, and I began it in 1988, is bring musicians over and tour them. And basically, in my last project, which was in these three republics, I brought over musicians from Hakassia, Altai, and Tuva. Got the funding together, partly funded it by using my field recordings, bringing out field recordings as CDs and flogging them on the gigs, you know. But this seemed to me important in several ways. As part of what I was doing, as well as doing concerts, before each concert, we did a workshop. And the concerts and the workshops were not only within academia. So we played small churches, youth clubs. You know, I mean, the last group that I brought over from the Altai Republic, we hit the big time. We did WOMAD, 40,000 people, Royal Opera House. But we also did a church hall in Cambridge, arts centres. And my hope in doing that was more than one hope, really. One was that it would, well, I have to say that in the workshops, the structure of the workshop was that I introduced the culture. They demonstrated the instruments and the music, and then everybody had a go. And I helped with the teaching, you know, so divided people up in groups, and they all had a go at what they wanted to do, throat singing or horsehead fiddle or eagle fiddle or whatever. And the idea was to take the experience out of academia and to involve ordinary people. We did it in academia as well, you know, we did it in the music faculty, Cardiff University, you know, Oxford, we did it in universities. But the idea was to broaden that experience, to disseminate it in new and exciting ways, really. But the other reason for doing it two other reasons for doing it. One is that these indigenous peoples in southern Siberia, and also in Mongolia, but that's probably the next project, they are struggling with the centralized effort to make everybody the same. So these peoples in southern Siberia have got Moscow organizing boundaries, reorganizing boundaries in order to increase Russification, which is what happened in the Soviet period. So it's a kind of backpedaling that's going on. And my hope was, not so much with the Tuvans, because they've got a presence on the world music circuit anyway, you know, on the global stage anyway, but with Hakassia and Altai, to give them the opportunity to say, you know, the world recognises we are Hakas, we are Altai, we sound different, we have our own music. So by giving them respect and attention over here and internationally, feeding back for their own cause, which is very, you know, a strong one, they're struggling. That was the intention with that. The third reason, which you may want to blot off, is that I always get up on stage and do my first set. I introduce their songs and we always end up with a joint thing. So it feels like somehow coming back home, you know what I mean? It feels that I feel very comfortable that I'm performing and relating to these musicians through music, really. Yes. I probably didn't answer your question.
No,
I've forgotten what
it was.
Well,
it was to do with recording. But it was, I suppose, you talked about how you've used the recordings and how you hope that they will be used in the future. But I suppose, again, maybe it's too much of an obvious question, but why
record?
Yeah.
Well, already I said to you that it does enable you to sensually reposition yourself back in the moment. Of course, you know, there is an argument that it's one step removed, so you're not back in the moment, but it does trigger it triggers the experience. So I suppose that is. I'm not really recording it in order to deposit it, to pass it on to other people. I'm not doing it for that. I'm doing it to help my own understanding of what's going on. And that's how I've used it so far, although I will be depositing. I'm in the middle of copying all my tapes for the National Sound Archive.
And in the way that your book is now being used in Mongolia, however you might find that slightly odd in some ways, would you like your recordings to be disseminated and used in whatever way in the communities where you've originally made them?
I would hope that if there has been this gap when they've lost their traditions, that might be one use for them. Of course, there's a problem, isn't there? Because the music you make is something to do with who you are and how you're situated. So if you want to be looking back to your cultural heritage and developing it, it is saying something about you, you know. And that's the argument that, you know, there is an argument. There's a divide between those traditionalists who think we need to perpetuate these sounds and those others who think that's not relevant today. Why should we bother to do that? If those recordings could be used by local people to inspire them to use their roots in some way, I would think that would be a great thing, really. Yeah, I would think that would be a great thing. If they're used here, to inspire people to maybe bring those people here or help them in some way. I don't see the point of the pure knowledge side of it, you know, because some of these people struggle. But the people I work with, they struggle in all sorts of ways, you know. I mean, Tuva has the highest murder rate in the Russian Federation, the lowest life expectancy. You know, you're told when you get to the capital, don't go out after 7 o'clock, you know. They're struggling with all these tick infestations and, I don't know, the Black Death in West Mongolia. We see them in world music concerts, and we see a very idealized version of what we think their lives are, you know. And I'm sort of interested in their lives, really, and the people performing the music. So I'm not an archival person in that sense. But if archives can be used in some positive way like that, then count me on board, you know.
Great. And I just wondered if you had any particular reflections on, so the centre, let me get the name right, that you set up within the Social Anthropology Department here in Cambridge.
Mongolia and Indian Asia Studies Unit.
Yes. Remind me what year that was. Was that just after your PhD?
Yes, it was. Yeah. So it was probably 88.
Okay.
It must have been 87, because I went to Inner Mongolia in 87. So it must have been 87. Mm. Finished the PhD in 86, went to Exeter, and then helped Kerry to set that up.
And how have you seen the role of music within that? And I suppose, again, just some of your reflections on, if one can call it that, this, but the sort of the music studies within that region, particularly within this country, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And how things might have developed.
Well, it's always been a frustration to me, because anthropologists, perhaps British anthropologists, have never really embraced music and dance. It's always been a peripheral thing. And perhaps that's why I cut off and went into the music faculty. It got very frustrating for me. But I find what's happened is that my own work now has got a global following, you know. And there are possibly coming up for, I don't know, maybe 20 people, you know, from Australia and France, and who are going to Mongolia and doing work there, and who are communicating with me. And having been based in the music faculty, I am now feeling that I want to renew my connection with anthropology. I'll never be, you know, it's the story of my life, really. It's a struggle, but I do see another, perhaps, now that I've gone away and in my absence become a big person, maybe there's a way of feeding music back into anthropology here. We'll have to wait and see.
Mm. And the sort of global community of scholars, if you want to call it that you can now see...
Young people.
Yeah.
So young,
and
yeah.
How would you, again, comment upon your impact within... where these studies are going and how they've developed and this sort of thing?
It's a new thing, you see. I've only really just realised it. But I discover that they are all referring to the book and they're looking to me. And this recent trip to Mongolia, the young French researcher that was there, thanked me for opening up the field. And he was describing my book in the very way that I hoped it would be used, you know. Without me setting it out, he wouldn't be able to be doing what he's doing. It was rather wonderful because he got up and performed throat singing for me as a thank you, you know.
It just felt very nice for having worked for many, many, many years in my own little furrow to know that people were finding it valuable, you know, finding it valuable, really. Yeah.
And how can you see that feel sort of progressing, if that's the right word, now?
Well, I'm hoping to help it to progress. I'm just turning my attention to how to do that, really, now, knowing that they're there. Knowing that I'm now about to start a different project, and how to, you know, sort of draw them in and develop this in some way. I don't want to talk very much about what I'm hoping to do because, you know, it always requires raising funding and it gets increasingly difficult and all of those things. So I have aspirations for nurturing these people, you know, so we have to see if I can manage to do that, really.